was part of our legacy from Bobby Van Dusen. He left us a CD of some of his playing. Our words of meditation this morning are from Lydia Child, who is one of the ladies that will be discussed later. And she said, "You find yourself refreshed in the presence of cheerful people. Why not make an honest effort to confer that pleasure on others? Half the battle is gained if you never allow yourself to say anything gloomy." And we'll meditate on that for a minute of silence, and then I'll ring the gong. And now I present Dr. Deborah Riles.
Good morning. Good morning. Walk away without my notes. Might be helpful. Long ago and far away in a city known as Concord, Massachusetts, there were a huge group of writers, philosophers, thinkers. And one of the people who lived in Concord is a gentleman by the name of Nathaniel Hawthorne. You may have heard of him. He wrote one or two small books. But Hawthorne had a small problem. He wanted to be an author, but nobody would buy his books. So it's very difficult to take care of your wife and three children when you're not selling books. And so in 1854, when Franklin Pierce became the 14th president of the United States, he gave Nathaniel Hawthorne the ambassadorship to England to help his dear friend financially. So Hawthorne goes to England, and he is writing back to his publisher, who is William Ticknor. And he says, "America is now wholly given over to a mass of scribbling women. And I should have no choice of success while the public taste is occupied with their trade, and should be ashamed of myself if I did succeed. What the mystery of these innumerable editions of the Lamplighter and other books, neither better nor worse. Worse they could not be, and better they need not be, when they sell by the hundred thousands." To put this in perspective, between the years 1850 and 1857, the publication dates that we're talking about with The Scarlet Letter, Hawthorne sold an amazing 4,500 copies. I'm going to let that sink in. That's over seven years. In 3 months, Susan Warner sold 450,000 copies. How many of you have ever heard of Susan Warner? How many of you have ever heard of Nathaniel Hawthorne? I thought so. Hawthorne got his revenge on his scribbling women. So I have for you a picture of the first this is the first Unitarian church in Concord, Massachusetts. And I have the quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson that says, "The happiest man in the world is one who learns from nature the lesson of worship." And I thought it would be a nice way to begin talking about Hawthorne's scribbling women. This is Susan Warner. She doesn't look like much, does she? But she is responsible for the first bestseller in the United States. She sold over 1 million copies. Now, let's put that into perspective. In the United States at this time, there are only 26 million people. Perspective. So we have Hawthorne with his 6,500, and we have Warner with her numbers. By the end of 1851, which is also the year that the Scarlet Letter was published, she had sold 750,000 copies in the United States and over 400,000 copies in Great Britain. She wrote the first book. It's called The Wide, Wide World. And this particular book combines Christian philosophy with submission to God's will. So this book is very didactic, which means it's preachy. And what she is encouraging is individuals to be aware of their religious responsibility in the world and to practice that, and that God will take care of you. Puritan providence at work. Now, she and her sister Warner, Anna Warner, were very popular, but they were highly religious. They changed religions several times until they ended up in the Methodist Church, which they promoted very much. Susan wrote the song, Jesus Bids Us Shine. You may be familiar with that. And her sister Anna wrote a song I'm sure you've heard, Jesus Loves Me. Susan wanted a song that they could teach the children to sing that would show them about God and Jesus. And so her sister Anna wrote, Jesus Loves Me, at least the first verse. And this is Warner's very simple tombstone. In fact, it's difficult to read, but it just talks about that she is the author of The Wide, Wide World, and that she hoped everyone would live by the guiding principles that God is love. Not a bad sentiment. This is Lydia Marie Child. Anybody ever hear of Lydia Marie Child? You did. She spoke of Lydia, gave you a quote from Lydia. You've heard of her. You may not know her, but you've heard her. So she wrote, Over the River and Through the Woods. You do know Lydia. You just don't know you know Lydia. She wrote the poem. She didn't write the music that it was set to, but she did write the poem. Her largest selling work, and she in this particular work went through 28 editions. And it is still available today. You can still buy the American Frugal Housewife. It's on Amazon. It's $19.95 if you really want. But it is exactly what it says. It's the frugal housewife. It was written for women who did not have servants. It was written to help new brides figure out how do you set up your home? Where do you put things? And she was very exacting. You put things here, you put things here. You do this at the bottom of the stairs, put a basket. So when you go upstairs, you can take things. When you come downstairs, you can bring it back down. Very, very helpful. Terms like that, she encouraged women to recycle tin cans. Canning was done with tin cans. All you had to do was buy the lid that went on it, and you could use it again. And she encouraged people who didn't have a whole lot of money that they could indeed grow a little garden in the backyard with enough vegetables that they could take care of their family during the lean times of winter. But she also sees the plight of women in the same way that Margaret Fuller did, and that is that women were less than slaves in their own home. In fact, Margaret Fuller says that slaves will be emancipated before women will. Yeah. In her book, Women in the 19th Century. Now, when I say that she saw the plight of women in the same way, she wrote supporting women. Much of what she wrote was to encourage women, to be helpful to women. Child is also the first person to write specifically for children. And her books were designed to help children overcome problems and issues in their life, much as we have people who write those same kind of books today. So in 1833, she published her book, An Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans. This is a seminal book because it started the abolitionist movement in New England. She was exacting in her detail. She did not cut any corners. She didn't make it pretty. She didn't gloss. She said, this is what is going on. This is how people who are Africans are being treated in the plantations. Don't drink rum. This is how people are being treated on the plantations in the South. Don't wear cotton. I mean, that specific. And it encouraged many people to begin the abolitionist movement, and particularly was a huge influence on William Lloyd Garrison, who published The Liberator shortly after he read her book. And so she becomes an important figure outside of literature and the scribbling that she wrote that Hawthorne didn't think was important, but this work was important. And many new housewives were very happy to have a book to help them. And this is what she says. While we bestow our earnest disapprobation on the system of slavery, let us not flatter ourselves that we are in reality any better than our brethren of the South. Thanks to the soul, to our soul and climate, and the early exertions of the Quakers, the form of slavery does not exist among us, but the very spirit of the hateful and mischievous thing is here in all its strength. The manner in which we use what power we have gives us ample reason to be grateful that the nature of our institutions does not entrust us with more. Our prejudice against colored people is even more inveterate than it is in the South. She didn't cut any. No mincing of words from Lydia. And by the way, this particular work sold 100,000 copies. 7,500, 100,000. Do you see why Hawthorne's a little peeved? She also supported work on Native Americans. Her novel, Hobomog, which was published in 1824, was written in 6 weeks. It is valued for its realistic portrayal of early American life and for its then radical, positive portrayal of a Native American hero as a noble Indian who was in love with a white woman, and that interracial marriages not only worked, but they should be viewed as the norm and not something to be horrified about. She also encouraged interracial marriages between blacks and whites. That made her less popular, but people still bought her books. Again, we don't often think about what is going on outside of the publication of a book. And this is her tombstone. Not very fancy. This is Fanny Fern, whose real name is Sarah Willis. And Fanny is the one that Hawthorne had. Oh, that's the fire the typist. Fire the typist, just fire. Fanny Fern is interesting because of all of the things that she did that just irritated the stew out of Hawthorne. She was the number one newspaper columnist in the United States. She wrote a column once a week for what will become the New York Times, and she was paid $100 for that column. Wow. One column. Her father was a newspaper editor. He was a deacon. Her brother, Nathaniel Parker Willis, was a writer and an editor. Her first marriage was happy, and then her husband died, left her with two children and a huge mountain of debt. Her second marriage provides the background for her novel, Ruth Hall. Ruth Hall is the work that Hawthorne had some issues with. She began attending Catherine Beecher. You know Catherine Beecher as in Harriet Beecher Stowe. This is her sister. She had a seminary, the Hartford Female Seminary, and she wrote pieces for her father's children's periodical, The Youth's Companion. Louisa May Alcott published in The Youth's Companion, just some of the women that were. She began writing to support her family after her husband divorced her. Remember I said the second marriage was the problem? He decided that he did not want her, and so in order to get rid of her, he started spreading rumors that she was unfaithful. And so she moved herself and her children out of that home, and he continued to the point that he finally was able to have the divorce to go through on the grounds of desertion. He couldn't make adultery stick because he couldn't find anybody. So, what do you do? You're a woman. You have children. How do you take care of yourself? Her family, though well-to-do, would not support her because they felt she was bad, because she had been divorced. Wasn't her fault, but... Oh, and just to put it in perspective, 2 weeks after the divorce went through, her husband remarried. Oops. Her letters were called Fern Leaves from Fanny's Portfolio. These are reprints of columns, and you'll notice it sold 46,000 copies in 4 months. 46,750, which according to the publisher surpassed the performance of Uncle Tom's Cabin that year. And over 70,000 copies were sold by the end of the year, and within a year it had sold 100,000 copies. Now, this story, Fanny Furness, bless you, is very, very autobiographic, and so a lot of people felt that it was successful because everybody wanted to read the dirt about her family because nobody liked her brother. She was also the first woman to go on record supporting Walt Whitman's poetry. Now remember, she's a newspaper columnist, and she's just not writing, oh, today is a happy day. She's writing, there's a new poet out there. His name is Walt Whitman. You should read his poetry. It's new. It's exciting. It's different. It will make you think. And people listened. In 1855, she was offered $100 for each column of a serialized story, an offer which she finally accepted, which made her the highest paper newspaper writer in the country. In fact, her name is equal to, and her position is equal to that of Margaret Fuller. Anybody ever hear of Margaret Fuller? Woman in the 19th century? Margaret Fuller's claim to fame is not woman in the 19th century. She was the first foreign newspaper reporter. She went overseas and reported. Her columns were sent via teletype from England to the United States, where they were published. So the first foreign newspaper correspondent was a woman, not a man. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
She became known for her advocacy of women's rights and women's independence. She was asked all different kinds of things, and she was a strong proponent of educational reform for children. She believed in the German school system, which was kindergarten, and dividing schools into what we call elementary, which they called elementary, middle, and high school. And much like Amos Bronson Alcott, who believed in children should be active and not passive learners, so he would take his kids, his students outside, and they would run through the woods. Novel, huh? children running. Kids don't run today. They just kind of look at you like, run? No, but he invented the game Duck, Duck, Goose. You ever play Duck, Duck, Goose? Red Rover? And he invented a game called Stop Go. You know it better as Red Light, Green Light. These are games he played with the children. Notice I said he played with the children. And she published articles about this and how great the concept of recess was in school, that children should not be forced to sit for 8 hours a day with only 20 minutes to eat their lunch, that they needed time to get up and play. They're children after all. Only two words adorn her gravestone, and those words are Fanny Fern. The stone itself is very simple. It's a plain cross with ferns all over it. It serves as a reminder of who she was. And there's the tombstone. And you'll notice it just says Fanny Fern. And that was at her request. That was what she left. This is how I wish to be remembered. And her children supported her in that. The last woman on our list is Catherine Sedgwick. And she is an amazing woman. She never married, not because nobody wanted her. She just didn't want them. As a child, she was cared for by Elizabeth Freeman, who was a former slave, often called Mom Bet. Her father helped Freeman gain her freedom by arguing her case in county court in 1781. She came to live with Sedgwick's family, and she is buried next to her in Stockbridge. Stockbridge, Massachusetts, you may have heard of the town. This is where Jonathan Edwards went to serve as a missionary to the Indians. You didn't know that? That's, well, have you ever heard of Norman Rockwell? Stockbridge. It's a small world. And this is Mumbet. Unlike Cooper, and her book is called Hope Leslie, that she is most famous for. Unlike Cooper, she accepts marriage between an Indian man and a white woman. Encouraged it. In fact, her character is rescued from the Indian tribe by Governor John Winthrop. And forced to live away from her husband and her two children. She has an infant in arms. And she escapes and goes back. And Sedgwick is very clear that this is what is right. It doesn't matter what color skin. She loves him. He loves her. They have children. They're happy. Leave them alone. Which, for some strange reason, Winthrop couldn't do that. He just was, oh, we won't go there. Her fiction repeatedly emphasized the political and personal need for liberty and independence. Her character, Hope Leslie, is very independent and does things her way and how she wants them. She frees Indian women from unjust imprisonment. Both Hope and her Indian double, who's Magawiska, question political authority. Magawiska saves Hope Leslie and her sister from being killed, but it costs her arm in stopping the blow that would kill Hope Leslie. She loses her arm. So it's, you know, again, strong women, independence. And we don't read these, and most people have never heard of them. Her writings focused on the woman's role in the new American Republic and the relationship between whites and Native Americans. Now, remember, she lives in Massachusetts, and this is the home of John Winthrop, who hated Indians with a passion. And if you're a Winthrop fan, I'm sorry. I'll pray for you. Winthrop, during the King Philip's War, when the King Philip's War was finished, rounded up all of the Indians that were from his tribe, the Penobscots, and sold them into slavery in the Caribbean. Men, women, and children as young as 2. If they were younger than 2, they were fostered into families so that they could be raised away from their Indian heritage and raised to know and fear God. It also revises notions of submissive womanhood by arguing that women must recognize their domestic spheres as empowering. And this is part of the concept of spheres, that men have a sphere and women have a sphere. The men's sphere is work to support the home, and the woman's sphere was home to support the husband. The spheres work together, but they're very distinct. Women don't go into business, men don't stay home. I always wondered what they would think if they saw how life was in our day. And this is Sedgwick's grave. These women are different. They're not what we think of when we think of women from the 1850s. We think of, I don't know, what do we think of? Most people could not name a woman who wrote in this time period, at least in American. They might come up with Emily Dickinson, but Dickinson wrote in the 1880s. They might come up with Mary Shelley, or what's her other, the other woman who wrote all of those books? Oh, Jane Austen. They might come up with her. But the reality is there were hundreds of scribbling women who wrote about life, who wrote about work, who wrote about the rights of men who were a different color, the rights of women in a world that didn't want to hear it. And they were successful because women who read these books go on and begin this little conference at Seneca Falls, and the women's rights movement begins in 1851. Coincidence? I don't know. But I think women were listening. And I believe the reason that you've never heard of these women, but you know who Hawthorne is, and Melville, writing at the same time, is because the canon of American literature was formed by men like Hawthorne and Ticknor. And Hawthorne got his revenge. We don't read these women. But I wanted to present them to you with the idea that maybe, just maybe, there are women writers out there that you've never heard of, and if you're looking for something good to read, that you will turn to them as possible sources. And thank you for your time.
Wow. It's an inspiration but to both men and women to see how much these women did. And it's sort of shaming that we don't know them better, you know? Well, anyway, this church is financially supported solely from contributions by our members and friends. If you would like your cash donation, which we're asking for now, or your check, if you want your cash to be recorded, please put it in an envelope provided with your name. And we will now gratefully receive an offering for the support of this church here and beyond our walls.